This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 270. Today we speak with Dr. Scott Manich about pastoral care in the emerging Reformed Church between 1536 and 1609. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 270. My name is Camden Busey. I'm recording once again from Wheaton, Illinois, a nice bright morning. And we have a delightful panel and an excellent subject lined up today. Let me introduce to you the people I have with me. First, we have a regular, Jim Cassidy, who is pastor of Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. He's also a PhD candidate in systematic theology at Westminster Theological Seminary. Welcome back, Jim. It's wonderful to speak with you again.
It's good to be back, Camden. Thanks.
We also have with us Dr. Carl Truman, who is professor of church history at Westminster Theological Seminary. He's also the pastor at Cornerstone OPC in nearby Ambler, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Dr. Truman. It's great to speak with you again as well.
Great to be back, Camden.
And we have an excellent guest. We are very pleased to welcome for the very first time to our program Dr. Scott Manich, who is professor of church history at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. He's done a number of great studies in Reformation history. We're delighted to have him today to speak about his new book. Welcome to the program, Dr. Manich. It's great to speak with you.
Well, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be with you today.
We have in front of us a superb title from the Oxford Studies in Historical Theology. It's published by Oxford University Press, titled Calvin's Company of Pastors, Pastoral Care and the Emerging Reformed Church, 1536 to 1609, written by Scott Manich. And we're going to be speaking about this book today, speaking about pastoral theology and pastoral care in Geneva and during the Reformation. But before we get right into our subject, speaking about this topic, I do need to mention that Christ the Center is listener-supported. We do encourage you to visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate. There you can partner with us, and we need more of your assistance and more of your help to help us to continue to produce and distribute all of these programs free of charge. We love doing it, but we need your help, so please visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate. We thank you so much for all of your support of everything we do at Reformed Forum and this particular program, Christ the Center. Well, I want to speak by passing things very quickly to Carl. Dr. Truman, you brought this book to my attention. I thank you so much for doing that. An excellent title it is. But would you mind explaining your history with this book and how excited you were to see it and why?
Well, I've known Scott for a few years now, and we had the pleasure of speaking together on a panel at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School last May or June, I think it was, wasn't it, Scott?
Right, that's right, yes.
We were invited to address sort of contemporary ecclesiastical issues. Kevin DeYoung was chairing the panel, and Scott gave a great paper there, which I suspect in essence is a summary of many of the salient points of the book. So I was looking forward to the book coming out with great anticipation. Got it maybe a month ago, and I have to say, don't often say this about church history books, even though it's my own field, it's a real page-turner. What interested me historically was the amount of work that Scott has done in the archives in Geneva and the synthesis, the interpretive synthesis he's produced relative to pastoral ministry in Geneva, not simply during the time of Calvin, but taking it right up to the beginning of the 17th century. And then the pastoral half of my brain was very interested in how Scott demonstrates that the reformed understanding of what it meant to be a pastor does evolve somewhat over time. The Reformation makes this tremendous shift in understanding of the power and the role of the pastor, places the word central, subordinates the sacrament somewhat to the preaching of the word, transforms the nature thereby of the Christian ministry. But of course, that story doesn't end with Luther and Calvin. That changes the lay of the land, raises new challenges that future generations of Protestants have to respond to. So I found the book extremely helpful personally in coming to a better understanding of why Reformed tradition understands the ministry in the way that it does. So I think it works It's an important contribution in two particular areas. One, the history of Geneva under Calvin and after Calvin. And second, the nature of the pastoral ministry as historically understood within the Reformed tradition.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Manich, I want to ask you about this study in particular as we begin, about the time period you've chosen to treat. Why begin in 1536 and end in 1609? That might be helpful for some of our listeners to hear why you chose that era.
Well, we remember that Calvin arrives in Geneva in July of 1536, and that's a pretty natural place to begin, thus, as Calvin comes to a city that's only recently embraced the Reformation, just 2 months before, and he's really given a tabula rasa where there's much that's uncertain, undefined, where institutions that have existed throughout the Middle Ages have crumbled, Catholic clergy have left the city en masse, and Calvin and the other pastors are faced with these enormous tasks of rebuilding a church and constructing a church according to their understanding of the Word of God. The 1609 date is a little more difficult to defend, but I think it can be defended. What I was interested in was looking at the course of pastoral ministry in Geneva over the long durée, so certainly during Calvin's lifetime, but I also wanted to explore how the vision of ministry changed or was reinforced during the ministry of Theodore Beza, who was John Calvin's successor in Geneva, who lives until 1605. So he has a long tenure in Geneva as a pastor, over 40 years. And then I wanted to go beyond Beza, asking, so how did things change following Beza's decline and departure from the pastoral office? And as it turned out, actually, there are a lot of important changes that take place right around the time of Theodore Beza's death in the early 17th century. Now, why 1609 and not 1610 or 1611? Quite frankly, I ran out of time in the archives. So I had spent 4 summers working diligently through the consistory minutes in Geneva, and I just had time to get through 1609, and I felt like I had enough really interesting material to make the project work with that.
Sure, and I certainly didn't feel like anything was lacking in this title. You'd certainly draw out a lot of features and elements of this time period, even down to some very interesting details that come out of the records that I've never encountered before. And I wanted to ask you about other studies of this time period and of this nature. How does your book fit in, and have there been any studies of recent note that have even treated this subject in this particular way?
Well, in the scholarship, actually, the generations after Calvin have long been neglected. Eugene Choisy wrote a very helpful book about 80 or 90 years ago that looked at the political alignment between the Company of Pastors and Geneva's magistrates during Beza's tenure, and noted important changes that took place. But Choisy really wasn't interested in pastoral life. He wasn't exploring the way in which pastoral ministry was conducted or ways in which it changed during the lifetime of Beza and thereafter. I've done some research over the years in the life and ministry of Theodore Beza, including his pastoral theology and his preaching. But by and large, this whole area of pastoral ministry in Geneva during Calvin's lifetime, but particularly after Calvin's lifetime, has really not been treated with the kind of detail that is necessary. So I felt like I was able to make a contribution both in exploring the theology of pastoral ministry, the practice of pastoral ministry in Geneva, not only during the time of Calvin, but thereafter. And I should mention, too, one important study that's appeared more recently, Elsie Ann McKee's book, where she has a beautiful collection of some of Calvin's writings relative to the pastoral office and related to pastoral theology. That's a very helpful volume, and I would recommend it to the listeners. But again, in terms of a full-length, careful study of Calvin's pastoral theology and practice, that really has not been done heretofore.
Mm-hmm.
Scott, would you be able to tell us a little bit about Calvin's venerable company of pastors? What exactly is it? How was it structured? What was expected of the duties of these men, et cetera?
Yeah, the institution that we know today as the Company of Pastors emerges in the mid-1540s. And this was a gathering of Geneva's pastors that met every Friday morning. And it included the pastors who worked in the city. And by the 1550s or 1560s, usually there are about seven or eight pastors who served the city churches. There are three main churches within the city walls. But the Company of Pastors also included pastoral staff who were serving small rural parishes in the surrounding countryside. And usually there were somewhere between 11 to 12 country parishes that were being served by Genevan pastors. So all told, the Company of Pastors included perhaps 19 or 20 men, sometimes professors from the academy in the arts and in New Testament and Old Testament would also sit on the Company of Pastors. And this group of men were committed to encouraging one another, holding one another accountable. They were also responsible for the day-to-day life of ministry in Geneva, making practical decisions about liturgy and practical decisions about who would preach where. They would also examine ministerial candidates coming up through the academy. And finally, as a number of scholars have noted, including Robert Kingdon, the Company of Pastors has a real external view as well. The Company of Pastors becomes kind of the international face of Genevan Calvinism. And as Bob Kingdon showed a number of years ago, the Company of Pastors will send missionaries to France and will correspond with churches in Scotland and in the Netherlands and in Hungary and Poland. So there's a real international dimension to the Company of Pastors ministry as well.
Were they accountable to the magistrate, or how did the dynamics between the magistrate and the Company of Pastors work out?
Now, that's a great question, Jim. It was complex. The Company of Pastors certainly insisted upon primary authority over the life of the church and over the preaching of the word. Now, in point of fact, the Company of Pastors and Calvin himself were all employees of the Republic of Geneva. Technically speaking, they could be fired within 48 hours notice. The magistrates were very suspicious lest these pastors establish a kind of new papacy in the city. So there's a kind of a push and pull between magisterial authority and pastoral authority in Geneva throughout the period that I studied. But on the whole, when it came to matters of installing pastors and dealing with theological controversies and addressing the international Calvinist movement, the Company of Pastors has a fair degree of autonomy. Not complete autonomy, but a lot of autonomy.
How were the people cared for before Calvin arrived, before this Company of Pastors came to fruition? What was pastoral care like in the years leading up to Calvin's arrival?
Well, that's a good question, too. Pastoral ministry looked very different in Catholic Europe before the onset of the Reformation. At the time of Geneva's Reformation, Geneva was part of a vast Catholic diocese, an enormous diocese. And at the time of the Reformation, in the vast majority of those dioceses, there really wasn't everyday preaching. Preaching was not part of parish life as it was expressed through the Mass or through the priest's ministry. Now, there was preaching in late medieval Catholic Europe, and certainly within the Diocese of Geneva, there was preaching, and it was done by mendicant preachers, Franciscans and Dominicans, who would travel about, or in the case of Geneva, the Franciscan house in the city and the Dominican house in the city, there was an agreed kind of alternation between preaching in one monastery one Sunday and then the next Sunday at the other. So there was preaching in Geneva, although it was not part of the what we might call the daily mass or during the regular course of the congregation at worship. Another difference was we don't have congregational singing in the parish life and diocesan life. There was singing by trained monastic choirs, but the practice of the congregation joining together in song, singing the Psalter, as was the case with Calvin's Geneva, that didn't occur. One of the primary ways that pastoral ministry took place and pastoral care took place in Catholic Europe, and that would include the Diocese of Geneva before the Reformation, was through the sacrament of penance or the sacrament of confession.
Mm-hmm.
And Catholic believers were required and expected to confess their mortal sins to their priest at least once a year, usually before the Easter celebration of the Eucharist. And so that was the place within the Catholic mode of ministry where priests would encounter individual sinners and would attempt to provide both absolution for sin and then prescribe works of satisfaction to address sin.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, when Calvin arrives and as the Protestant Reformation is established throughout Europe, the sacrament of penance was one of the things to go, although within the Lutheran world, continued kind of private confession to a pastor was encouraged. It wasn't mandatory, but it was encouraged. That did not happen in Calvin's Geneva, at least not formally speaking. If I can just add one more comment, as a replacement for the sacrament of penance, Calvin institutes household visitation. So in Calvin's Geneva, the faithful were visited once a year, usually before Easter, by a pastor and an elder, sometimes by a city magistrate accompanying them. So very different models of pastoral care and pastoral ministry before the Reformation in Geneva and after.
Scott, what was the dynamics, as far as you were able to ascertain, amongst the pastors? Calvin obviously becomes the de facto leader amongst the pastors, not wanting to become or perceived as a popish type figure, of course. But were there severe disagreements among the pastors? If so, how were those disagreements worked out and addressed among the pastors' company?
Yeah. Well, Calvin has a very high view of the equality of the ministry. Now, in point of fact, he has a great deal of influence in the city and a great deal of influence within the company, both by his intelligence, by his international reputation, by his formidable theological mind. So, without a doubt, Calvin is the brightest light in the firmament of pastoral life in Geneva, if we want to put it that way. But in theory, Calvin insists on the equality of the ministry. There should be no hierarchy. There should be no bishop. There should be no supreme superintendent who has real authority, juridical authority over his peers. And we see that at work within the life of the Company of Pastors. The Company of Pastors would meet again every Friday. They usually meet for a couple of hours behind closed doors. A secretary would take minutes of those meetings, and those minutes are still available to us. They've been published by the House of Dreux, the publishing house in Geneva. And in those minutes, we see the company often having disagreements between themselves over points of doctrine, points of practice. What would generally happen is that when those disagreements occurred, there'd be intense conversation, sometimes over a number of weeks. Votes would be taken and majority ruled. When a decision was made by the company, it was expected that all the members would subscribe to it. So the company didn't allow for open public dissent. And if a pastor kind of tried to buck the company and became particularly outspoken and critical in public about decisions made by the company of pastors, that was a recipe for losing one's job, actually. But one thing that I thought was very interesting and in many ways very healthy about the way in which the company of pastors attempted to preserve unity while also being open to airing differences. Four times a year before the quarterly communion service, the ministers again would gather behind closed doors for what they called the quarterly censure. And that was a meeting where if any pastors had animosity toward a fellow pastor, there were any disagreements, if one pastor was suspected of preaching doctrine that was not in accord with the statement of faith of the church, the company would address that directly, again, behind closed doors, if need be, censuring one of their colleagues, calling them to repent or calling them to correct their error. That was all done in secret, so that then when, as pastors, they took the Lord's Supper a few days later, they could do it, acknowledging harmony among themselves. Just one little interesting side note, at the end of this quarterly meeting, they would share a bowl of soup together, so they'd have lunch together, again, expressing their unity in the sense that God had called them together to be a company of pastors and to work together and to support one another and hold one another accountable. So the way in which, practically speaking, the company functioned, they were accountable to one another, they encouraged one another, they spoke with one voice, at least in public, and they shared fellowship with one another.
That quarterly censure, I believe, is something that a lot of Christian Reformed churches continue to do among their consistories. Maybe not in a formal way of trying to root out error, but as a way to correct and encourage one another to more fervent, you know, house visitations, that sort of thing. So that practice certainly has foundations earlier on in the Reformation.
Right, right.
I was wondering if, Scott, could you comment on the figure of Theodore Beza a bit? Some of the most fascinating bits of your book that I was really unaware of before were these little vignettes of the life and influence of Beza. I remember University of Cambridge had this magnificent portrait of Beza hanging outside the head librarian's office because he donated Codex Bezae
right,
to the university during his time in Geneva. But could you tell the listeners a bit more about him? He's often thought of as this rather austere and cold systematizer of Calvin. Now, you and I know that's simply not true intellectually, but culturally he was quite an interesting figure as well.
Oh, in so many ways, Beza is a fascinating figure, kind of a polymath. Not only is he an outstanding theologian, but he's a poet. He is instrumental in translating the Psalter into French. Someone else put it into music, but he was instrumental in the creation of the Genevan Psalter. He wrote satire. He did biblical exegetical work. Just a remarkable minister, a remarkable preacher, a very gifted leader to follow in Calvin's wake in Geneva. Beza does have kind of a bad reputation. He is seen as a systematizer. Sometimes some scholars have contrasted Calvin's more humanistic, Christ-centered theology to Beza's more abstract, scholastic theology. And actually, I've tried to show in this book, I've also tried to show in some of the other things that I've written, that's a caricature that doesn't bear the weight of the evidence. When you look at Beza's enormous literary corpus, certainly his school theology, the books that he writes that are intended to be used in the schools, employs Aristotelian categories and definitions, and he's committed to employing logic to describe the anatomy of theological arguments and to arrive at clarity and truth. That's certainly the case. But across his literary corpus, It's rich with pastoral insight. He writes devotional literature. He writes prayers, poetry. He's a man who's very interested not only in defending the Christian faith, but in enriching the spiritual experience of Christians and providing real consolation and hope to them in their Christian journeys. This was borne out to me, and actually this was one of the things that prompted this project to begin with some 12 years ago. I spent a summer at the Meter Center in Grand Rapids, Michigan, at Calvin Seminary, reading through Baze's sermons. We have about 86 extant sermons from his ministry, and I was so impressed at how rich they were in terms of pastoral insight, in terms of advice, consolation, spiritual wisdom that was embedded in these sermons, and it kind of exploded the myth that so many had, and a misconception that perhaps I had as well, that Baze was this austere, abstract, scholastic theologian. He certainly wasn't a brain on a stick. This is a man who was vitally involved both in defending the church in print, but also through a very rich and faithful ministry within the city. Again, he is Calvin's successor when Calvin dies in 1564, and Baze is preaching into his 80s. He preaches sermons four or five years before he dies, and he dies at age 86 in 1605. Perhaps Baze's greatest contribution, in retrospect, is his loyalty to Calvin and his attempt to really preserve what he saw as the biblical model and biblical doctrine that Calvin had established in the Genevan Reformation. So Beza, much of what we credit Calvin for, Beza is instrumental in preserving, both in Geneva and then beyond Geneva, because his ministry extended well beyond the boundaries of Geneva as well, as well as Calvin's.
How did Calvin come to meet Beza, and what was the nature of their relationship? Did it develop over time or change at all?
Well, the first time the two men met was in 1548. Theodore Beza had grown up in France. He was of noble birth. In fact, he was, in terms of his birth, he was a blue blood. He came from certainly a higher station in society than did Calvin. He was trained in law, as Calvin was, and then just fell in love with poetry and became a highly regarded poet in the circle of a group of humanists in Paris during the 1540s, still a Roman Catholic, although there's evidence that he had begun questioning much of Catholic faith 10 years before his actual conversion to Protestantism, which takes place in 1548. He describes his conversion in one of his letters. He had secretly married a common woman, and they were living together. Although becoming very well known and highly regarded as a poet, he was tormented by a promise that he had made earlier in life that when the opportunity arrived, he would leave France for the sake of the gospel. And then he became deathly ill, and it was during that period of illness in the summer of 1548 that he made a vow to the Lord that if God healed him, that he would leave France and declare himself a Protestant. And that's, in fact, what happened. He regained strength, and he and his wife, Claudine, fled Paris, and they went to Geneva and met Calvin. And Calvin actually performed the public wedding that they had never had in St. Pierre's Church late in the fall of 1548. And at that point, Beza really holds Calvin in very high esteem. Calvin will be instrumental in arranging for Theodore Beza's first academic post. Beza is placed as professor of Greek at the Lausanne Academy down the lake. And so for the next 10 years, Beza will be in Lausanne, an instrumental leader of the Reformed religion there in Lausanne, training pastors, some of whom will go into France as missionaries. And all the while, during that 10 years, from 1548 to 1558, Beza will be in correspondence with Calvin, occasionally will meet with Calvin, and will describe himself as a loyal follower of Calvin's thought and ministry. So the two men, their friendship is really forged during that decade that Theodore Beza is in Lausanne. And then, as things deteriorate in Lausanne, Calvin will invite Beza to come back to Geneva in 1548, and Beza will become the first rector of Calvin's Academy in early 1559. So the men had a long history. Beza always saw himself in adulthood as a kind of protege of Calvin, a disciple of Calvin, and as a very good friend of Calvin's.
He comes across in your book, Scott, as a really human figure. Two things stuck out in my mind. One was the book that I can't remember if he wrote it or he translated it to give to his father, because his father was a Roman Catholic, and trying to persuade his father to embrace the Protestant gospel. And the other one was the fact that he and his wife, I think, were criticized for decorating their house too nicely when he became a senior man in Geneva. And I was thinking that's probably a great thing for a lot of pastors' wives to read, to know that, yeah, in the 16th century, that the wives of the great men were under just the same scrutiny, subject to just the same kind of criticism.
Yeah, I was so grateful to uncover some of those little anecdotes, both from the consistory minutes that I read and also from the minutes of the Company of Pastors. And there are a few really interesting anecdotes in Theodore Beza's own writings. But, following his conversion, again, he came from a noble family from France. He effectively renounced the family fortune when he converted to Protestantism. And then in the following decade, tried very hard to convince his father to embrace the evangelical faith, to embrace the gospel. And Theodore Beza's, one of his most important works, called his Confession of Faith, was written with the express purpose of trying to explain Protestantism to his father and encourage his father to embrace the gospel. Theodore Beza had a very deep and rich marriage relationship with his wife, Claudine. They were husband and wife for many, many years. She dies in the late 1580s, and Theodore Beza is heartbroken, and both in one of the poems that he writes and also in several letters, we get this human dimension of a pastor, but also of a husband who is really devastated by the loss of a very dear wife. And if I might just add one other thing, in a previous project a decade ago, I spent a lot of time reading through Theodore Beza's correspondence. And Theodore Beza really had a large capacity for friendship, and that comes through in his letters, particularly in his letters, but in some of his published materials as well. This is a man who values friendship, who had a lot of friends, and who is a loyal friend over the years in his correspondence and in his day-to-day activities.
Scott, would you be able to tell us a little bit about the recruitment process in Geneva? I know you have a section about that in there. How did Calvin go about recruiting pastors for the company?
Well, that's actually one of the findings that is both surprising and very striking. Throughout Calvin's lifetime, Calvin recruits members of the Company of Pastors almost exclusively from expatriate Frenchmen. Geneva has become, during Calvin's lifetime, a kind of hub for international Calvinism, and particularly Frenchmen fleeing persecution in France come to Geneva. Many of them are pastors, and Calvin will put many of these French exiles to work in the company. So that during Calvin's lifetime, I believe only one or two men on the company of pastors are actually local candidates. So the company of pastors during Calvin's lifetime consists almost entirely of foreigners, Calvin himself included. And that pattern actually continues then for the next several decades, begins to be corrected somewhat in the 1580s and 1590s. And the real decisive turn occurs around the turn of the century, around the year 1600, when, for a variety of reasons, one of which was magisterial pressure, the company of pastors becomes far more intentional about hiring local men rather than simply hiring talented Frenchmen who have come over either short-term or long-term seeking refuge in the city of Geneva. And if I might say, this is one way in which Geneva really is quite different than many other cities. In many other cities during the time of the Reformation, the first generation of pastors was often converted priests who had converted to Protestantism and become, in a period of a few years, they moved from being a Catholic priest to being a Lutheran minister or a Reformed minister. That wasn't the case in Geneva. In Geneva, we have a mass exodus of Catholic clergy at the time of Geneva's Reformation in the 1535 and 1536. And consequently, there's this very significant vacuum of leadership in Geneva. And Calvin fills that vacuum really by drawing upon talented foreigners. And even after the Genevan Academy is established, which one would expect would provide a ready crop of local young men ready to assume leadership in their own church, in point of fact, again, it's three or four decades before a significant number of local Genevan men occupy pastoral posts in Geneva or in the surrounding countryside. That may be one of the weaknesses, actually, of the vision of ministry and of training in Calvinist Geneva during the 16th and early 17th century. The Genevan pastoral corps was very slow in hiring, integrating local men in the ministry of the church.
What were their typical responsibilities? What were pastors at this time expected to do, and how did they go about doing that?
Well, again, when I started this project, certainly I knew they preached a lot. I was so very impressed by how much these pastors did, and very much impressed with how difficult the pastoral office was in Geneva. For one, they preached, of course, and they preached a lot. Calvin probably preached somewhere between 20 to 25 sermons every month. It wasn't uncommon for a city pastor to preach three or four times a week. In Geneva, within the city walls, there were early morning sermons, in fact, three times a week, sermons at 4:30 in the morning to service the various maids and butlers who worked in the city who would have to go off to work. So a very early morning preaching service, and then there was every day in several of the churches a 6 a.m. preaching service. And then, of course, on Sundays, you have the very early service, but then you have the larger 8 a.m. Worship service, and then catechetical sermon at noon on Sunday, and then another preaching service at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. So certainly pastors preached, and they preached a lot. And it was expected that all the city preachers and all the countryside preachers would preach. So They didn't have a conception of a minister of the gospel who didn't preach. No executive pastors, no pastors who whose duties did not include a lot of preaching. And then, in addition to that, the members of the company of pastors were required every Thursday to attend consistory meetings, and the consistory meetings are these very intensive face-to-face disciplinary hearings that the pastors would engage in along with elders every week of the year. And those consistory meetings would regularly last several hours. It wasn't uncommon for 20 to 30 defendants to come before the consistory, having committed various sins, ranging from public drunkenness to spousal abuse, to swearing, to adultery. The list goes on and on. So a large part of the pastor's ministry involved intensive face-to-face counseling and disciplining, and that occurred weekly. In addition, the company of pastors meetings that took place on Fridays, where the pastors again would deal with questions of doctrine and church procedure, and also provide insight into the conflicts and controversies of international Calvinism. In addition to those kind of set meetings, many of the company of pastors had special responsibilities, either teaching at the academy or providing special help at the city hospital. Some were responsible, for example, to serving as chaplains for the army when it was on campaign. And then, in addition to all of that, the 20% of the members of the company of pastors during the period that I looked, that I studied, actually wrote books during their tenure in office in Geneva. So many of them were kind of pastor scholars and had significant roles in terms of writing, whether it was poetry or prayers or sermons or polemical pieces.
I don't know if you have any insights on the Michael Servetus trial and eventual execution. If you have any insights that you could share with us. Again, you kind of covered it, scratched at it a little bit in previous comments, but I don't know if you have anything particular to share.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about the Servetus case is it never comes before the consistory. So he was not disciplined by the church per se. In cases that are notorious or capital offenses, such as witchcraft or sodomy or kind of blatant heresy of the type that we see with Servetus, those cases did not come before the consistory. They went directly to the magistrates, who would handle them as criminal offenses. Now, in the case of Servetus, to be sure, Calvin is leading the charge with the prosecution. Calvin takes a very active role in the civil case against Servetus, criminal case against Servetus. So Calvin acts as a kind of advisor to the prosecution. He seeks to dissuade Servetus of his views. And at the end of Servetus' life, Calvin even calls for a more humane form of execution. But Calvin is in favor of the execution of Servetus. But it needs to be noted that all of that occurs not within the consistory chambers, and it's not really a ecclesial case per se, but it's more of a magisterial one. At the end of the day, it was the magistrates who executed Michael Servetus, not the church. The consistory had no authority to impose corporal punishment on anybody.
I wonder if Scott could just give us the 30-second version of why the idea that the company of pastors and the consistory were a kind of religious Gestapo simply isn't borne out by the records. The image is very much of Calvin running Geneva like the Ayatollah Khomeini ran Iran. But it's very clear when you read Scott's book that although, as in all human systems, there are abuses of power there, the overall thrust was really in a very different direction.
Yeah, well, thank you for that question. One of the major parts of my project was, in fact, to track church discipline very carefully through the consistory minutes over almost three quarters of a century. And the number of cases the consistory deals with are enormous. And I can understand why scholars 30 or 40 years ago may have kind of, given their modern sensibilities, have been shocked by the sheer number of disciplinary cases and the kinds of sins for which people were disciplined. So 30 or 40 years ago, the word on the street, the common parlance among scholars, was that Reformed church discipline was a form of social control where mean-spirited pastors were imposing their religious dogma on a largely unresponsive populace. And in the last 30 years, scholarship has really changed its mind regarding that. Certainly, again, the consistory does go against the grain of modern sensibilities in some senses, but someone like a Bob Kingdon and others have noted the really socially positive aspect of church discipline. And so my research really confirms that and pushes that a little further, trying to show that the consistory in Geneva, certainly it could be overly intrusive, and certainly it could be heavy-handed, and sometimes was. But at the end of the day, we see the pastors really engaging life-on-life ministry, being willing to enter into the pain and the tragedies and the sinfulness of the lives of their congregation, trying to bring about, through discipline, repentance and healing, and healing broken relationships between spouses and between neighbors and friends, trying to protect the weak. In other words, from my vantage point, when I look at the larger story of church discipline in Geneva, I see church discipline as a form of pastoral care, certainly subject to abuse, and sometimes that is evident. But these are pastors who are very courageously entering into the most painful, the most tragic aspects of people's lives, their parishioners' lives, and trying to bring the gospel to bear and bring God's healing, repentance, and reconciliation.
Now, of course, with a number of pastors here on the panel, I would be remiss if I didn't ask about pastoral compensation. How were the pastors at this time compensated? And I see that you even go to the lengths of correlating that with the price of wheat, etc. What were the thought processes as a congregation sought to compensate their pastors, and how did that differ maybe between the city and the countryside?
Well, the Genevan pastors were city employees. So they were paid not by their congregations per se. They were paid by the magistrates. And they were paid in two installments, so they were paid biannually. And as the century moves on, compensation included not only a monetary payment, but also payment in nature. They might receive wheat, or they might receive wine, to supplement their salaries. One thing that's clear is that the Genevan pastors were not paid very well. Now, certainly, the city pastors were paid somewhat better than the countryside pastors were paid. It was assumed that pastors in the countryside could supplement their income by raising vegetables in a garden or by animal husbandry, by orchards. So it was assumed that countryside pastors would be able to live off the land in a way that city pastors could not. But nonetheless, at the end of the day, it doesn't appear that the pastors were paid particularly well. And the concern about indigent pastors appears in the records time and time again. There are a number of instances where pastors really are forced to leave pastoral ministry in Geneva and look for charges in France where they will be paid a little bit better and be able to support their families. So being a pastor in Geneva was not only a lot of hard work, but it wasn't always compensated very well. And here again, on the whole, one really had to admire the diligence and the self-sacrifice of these pastors and their families. Many of the pastors had large families, 8, 9, 10, 12 children was certainly not uncommon. And as you can imagine, trying to support a large family on a small pastoral income was a real difficulty for many of these pastors. Now, some pastors had come from France with miniature fortunes, and so they could live a little more affluently, and that was the case with someone like Antoine de Chandieu or Theodore Beza. But by and large, most of Geneva's pastors lived a pretty hand-to-mouth existence.
Well, Dr. Marinich, I do want to thank you so much for joining us. And for the listeners, I want to say we've only begun to scratch the surface of the wealth of material that's in this book. So there's many more things that could be said, and I would encourage you to pick this book up. But Dr. Marinich, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much for speaking with me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Anytime. We'd love to have you back someday. Maybe we can talk about some other features of this book. Again, for the listeners, the book's titled Calvin's Company of Pastors, Pastoral Care and the Emerging Reformed Church, 1536 to 1609, published by Oxford University Press. If you'd like more information about Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, where Dr. Marinich teaches, you can visit them at teds.edu. You can also find Westminster online, where Dr. Truman teaches, at wts.edu. And we're available online as well at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs as well as everything that we're up to. If you'd like to get a hold of us, just send us an email at mail@reformedforum.org. I want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.